That's another thing that drives me a little nuts is I feel like we've all been taught that certain things cause insulin resistance when it's actually telling our liver to release more glucose, but it's been dumbed down by the healthcare industry. So we've been taught that dawn phenomenon hormones produce insulin or lead to insulin resistance. But when you actually look at what those hormones are doing, they're actually telling our liver to produce more glucose.
Welcome to the Reclaim Your Rise podcast. My name is Lauren Bongiorno, nationally board certified health coach and founder and CEO of Risely Health, where we help people and families impacted by type 1 diabetes take ownership over their lives so that they can transform with more freedom and confidence. Everyone has a different reason to be here. You might be seeking knowledge, support, or community, but at your core, I know that you long for something deeper. You're here for transformation. And that's what the Reclaim Your Rise podcast is all about. A quick reminder before we start the show that nothing you hear on the Reclaim Your Rise podcast should be a substitute for personalized professional medical advice. Please always consult your physician or other medical professional before making any changes to your diet, insulin dosages, or healthcare plan. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Reclaim Your Rise. So happy that you're here with us today. This is your host, Lauren Bongiorno, and today my wonderful guest, Ginger Vieira, is here to join me in a conversation around all of the hormones that T1Ds don't produce that you may not know about. We often hear just about insulin, obviously, and that we need to take it, but there's some other hormonal stuff going on that as you're listening, you might be like, wow, no one's ever told me that, or wow, that makes a lot of sense. So if you don't know Ginger, she's been on the podcast before. You can listen back to episode 33 for her entire background and story, but she is an author, video creator, and journalist with 25 years with T1D experience. The books she's written include Exercise with Type 1 Diabetes, Dealing with Diabetes Burnout, Stop Overtreating Lows, and Pregnancy with Type 1 Diabetes. Fun fact, I own all of them. And in addition to being an avid writer, Ginger's background includes being a certified personal trainer, Ashtanga yoga instructor, cognitive coach, and former competitive power lifter. Without further ado, Ginger, welcome to the show.
Lauren, thank you for having me. So good to see you again.
I feel like making that intro concise was difficult because I can talk so much about you and how much of a fangirl I was for years before we became friends.
That means a lot.
Yes. So I know the last time you were on the show, we talked a lot about your journey with diabetes and into, you know, a lot of the work that you do in the professional space around diabetes today, but we brought you back on because we were like, we want to educate people and the community on, you know, what is happening to our bodies when we're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, other than just the obvious, because there are like these background things that are happening with our hormones. And you were the expert that I'm like, Ginger is going to tell this and describe it best. And it's not just going to be like a dissertation in, you know, all of the like, just right. Like medical terms that maybe we're not going to be engaged with. And I'm really excited for people to listen. So my opening question for you is, when did you first learn that there were other hormones that T1Ds don't properly produce other than just insulin?
Yeah. Well, so a few years ago, I learned about one of these hormones. But then I think it was only last year, maybe actually it's 2024. So 2022, the end of 2022, a woman reached out to me because of an article I'd written about one of these hormones, amylin. And she said, did you know there's actually four others? And she is like a science heavy medical researcher who has T1D. And so that is when I learned about the others and was like, so that's not that long ago. Do you know what I mean? And it really, once you learn about these, it gives you so much more understanding of why you cannot do this perfectly.
I think we often like navigate through the dark and we're like, all right, well, our body doesn't produce insulin, but we have insulin. And so why can't we do it as best as our you know, pancreas would. Yeah. And when you really start to look at what's working against us, I think it allows you to just give yourself more grace. First hormone that I first thought of was taught was ghrelin. And that one, when it hit me, I was like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. Like just with hunger, and we'll get more into it, but I didn't either. Yeah. I didn't know that there were other hormones as well that we didn't produce. There's a lot we're going to talk about today, from appetite, hunger and fullness cues, insulin sensitivity, how much glucose your liver produces all day long, food digestion. Let's start with, what are the six?
I'm going to start above the six is, you know, when you have type 1 diabetes, your immune system is attacking and destroying beta cells, and your pancreas creates islet cells, and then islet cells are responsible for these five other types of cells, right? Not the hormones yet, but the cells. So you have alpha cells, beta cells, the ones we hear about the most that produce insulin, gamma, delta, and epsilon cells, right? So we've heard all these like sorority terms, right? They actually have a purpose in your body. And so all five of those cells produce things that are, produce hormones that are really critical for managing your blood sugar, your appetite, your insulin sensitivity, how quickly you digest food. But when the beta cell has been attacked and destroyed, it disrupts the communication with those other cells that are responsible for the production of those other hormones. So the whole like conversation is thrown off, and in many cases, not even happening. Like beta cell and alpha cell are supposed to talk to each other and work together. So the beta cell isn't there to talk to the alpha cell. So the alpha cell isn't managing the hormones it's responsible for. So that is the big umbrella problem. And no one explains that to people with diabetes. I don't know why.
Right. It's almost like at work, if you have your manager who's the beta cell, let's say, and then you have someone you're managing who's the alpha cell, and then beta cell just goes bye-bye and alpha cell's like, wait, like, what should I do today? And like, where do I need to prioritize? And asking all right. the questions and not able to do the work efficiently.
Yeah. So it's all screwed up. Okay. So let's go to the hormones. Insulin, we all know that one. Then you have, I kind of like argue with myself of which order to go through on these. Let's start with amylin. So amylin tells your body a few things. One, it tells you, your brain, when you're full while you're eating. And I find that people who have lived with type 1 for most of their lives might not notice that they are constantly hungry or never quite feel full after eating. The people I've interviewed who are most aware of it are people who are diagnosed in adulthood, because they've had so much of their life of having appetite regulation and proper signaling to their brain that they're full. So some people say, well, I've had type 1 for 30 years and I've never noticed that I'm always hungry. And it's like, yeah, I think you've probably gotten really used to it. That's a big thing that amylin does. And it also suppresses glucagon. So a lot of these hormones suppress glucagon. Glucagon is a hormone produced by your pancreas that tells your liver to release stored sugar. And this will frustrate the heck out of you once you realize what's going on. In people with type 1, we are overproducing glucose from our liver all day long because we don't have these other hormones to say, hey, I just ate a meal. I don't need this extra sugar from my liver. Like, calm down, take a nap. My food is plenty. So your liver is supposed to not produce very much glucose anytime you eat, really, because it doesn't need to, right? When you're sleeping all night, your liver is producing glucose to give you fuel because you're not eating. It's that backup source, because our brains need second by second delivery of glucose in order to function.
Are there complications, I don't know if you know, Ginger, that are linked specifically to the taxation that is on our liver over time?
I can't say that I've ever even looked that up. That's a great question. But the result of overproducing glucose all day long means that we need more insulin than we would if we didn't have type 1. And insulin stores excess glucose as body fat. So this means that it's that much harder for us to manage our weight and just our blood sugar, right? We just need that much more insulin than a non-diabetic.
Right. And then you throw in the, like we're talking about now, the struggles of not even just your liver overproducing, but you not having those fullness cues. Then you're also having that struggle, which is, am I eating what my body needs for energy or am I overeating? What is enough? So with amylin specifically, have you noticed that in your own personal journey? Like, have you been able to really like cue into, hey, like maybe my body isn't able, like do you feel that your body's unable to tell you when you're full? And like, how do you personally mitigate that?
So I feel like in my mid-20s, when I really developed a healthier relationship with food, which is a whole different topic, right? The way diabetes messes up your relationship with food. I feel like I didn't know that it was this hormone dysfunction, but I did feel like, I think that in type one, because we're taking all this insulin, it just makes us feel hungry all the time. That was my own personal theory. And that I had to learn how to just be comfortable with that hunger, knowing that it didn't seem logical or rational. And so I got like just kind of good at talking myself through it and eating what felt like a reasonable amount of calories and stopping myself and being comfortable with that sense of hunger. Today, I'm really glad to share that I take metformin, and metformin helps your body compensate for a lot of these hormones that we are lacking. We can dig into that later if we have time, but that metformin definitely helps me feel full sooner, and it suppresses that extra liver glucose.
In a way, before I knew about amylin, I almost felt like ignorance was bliss in a way, because it was like, I didn't realize that. So I had to kind of just, like, I didn't know that. Like now sometimes knowing that, I'm like, okay, you overthink it a little bit too much. But then, you know, when I was learning about that, I was like, okay, like just take a step back, just like listen to your body, like intuitively eat. I think there is a way for sure to do that.
Yeah.
And you know, we're going to have you back on the podcast to talk about low blood sugars and over-treating lows, and we can talk about that more then. But I do think, you know, even just that alone, listening to your body cues is hard, because it's like you could have a full meal of dinner and then you go low and you're like, wait, like I really am full. Like I know I am not hungry, but then your body's like, no, like you are, well, you will eat anything in the fridge right now. So
yeah,
it is a little bit of a challenge. So on one hand, it's like ignorance is bliss, I guess, because then you're not like buying into the belief as much. But then on the other hand, it gives yourself really like an understanding of why it may be happening. So,
okay. Yeah. And a reminder to, you know, that your body can't quite really be trusted and your appetite cues aren't really being honest with you, you know?
And I think too, like understanding the role of protein, I would imagine is important, because protein is something right. that keeps you fuller longer. And so if you're already have something working against your body, then really making sure to prioritize protein at every meal to help satiate you could be really
important. And bulky veggies, right? Like that combination would be, yeah. Okay. So that's amylin.
Okay.
Then we're going to hit up glucagon. So glucagon is the hormone that your pancreas produces, which we already kind of mentioned, right? And we often all might know about emergency glucagon, you know, that you give yourself during severe low or someone else gives you. But glucagon tells your liver to produce glucose. But the problem is that the next hormone is somatostatin. I'm always unsure if I'm really saying it right, but I think that's how you say it. Somatostatin kind of looks like the word tomato and statin. And this hormone is critical with the relationship with glucagon. So when your blood sugar is dropping, normally in a non-T1D body, somatostatin would tell your alpha cells to release glucagon, which would then tell your liver to release glucose, preventing low blood sugar. This is why non-diabetics don't have low blood sugars, because of somatostatin. But somatostatin relies on beta cells to communicate, right? So it can't do its job to protect us from low blood sugars because it doesn't have that conversation happening with the beta cells because they've been damaged or destroyed. So somatostatin can't do its job to say, hey, blood sugar's dropping, release glucose and produce less insulin.
Mm-hmm. I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I've heard before that if you are sitting, let's say at 55 for a while and you don't treat it, that you will eventually start to come up. But from this conversation, what I'm understanding it to be is not so much the somatostatin that's working, more so it's just that overproduction of your liver is going to eventually kind of like catch up and maybe give you a little bit of extra sugar if you didn't have access to sugar. Is that correct? Have you heard that before?
So your liver has, you know, unless you've been starving yourself for a week, your liver has plenty of glucose in it to save you from any low. It's just, we're missing that communication. What can happen, my understanding, and I've asked this specifically to Jenny Smith, who's a type 1 and a diabetes educator with Gary Shiner. She's brilliant. I've asked her, you know, can just a 55 is a good low, right? I don't mean mild as in that's not a real low, but you're still conscious, right? And I've asked her if that can trigger your liver to release glucose. She said that her understanding is that it really requires a devastating low. And I know people who've survived from severe low blood sugars where they lost consciousness and they had seizures, and their liver is what saved them, right? So that when it can't save you is if the amount of insulin you have on board is too much for your liver's glucose to counter, right? So it does actually take a lot to die from a low blood sugar, because that severe low will finally trigger your liver to release stored glucose. That doesn't mean you won't suffer a seizure and unconsciousness, and that's really scary and can be, you know, I had a friend who had a severe low, and she woke up in the kitchen to her diabetes alert dog licking her face. Her pump accidentally emptied all of its insulin into her. It was a total pump malfunction. Gosh. And so her dog couldn't save her because it was too much, right? She woke up and she tried to tell Siri, "Hey, Siri, call 911. But she had had a seizure and been lying there for so long that she couldn't actually make the words sound right to Siri. So Siri couldn't understand what she was saying. And she had to wait until she could finally talk clearly enough to tell Siri to call 911. But her liver did save her.
Wow. Well, that's obviously, you don't want to get to that point, but it is kind of just, you know, it's nice to know that there is, you know, your body is working in those dire situations to support you and get you back up.
Yeah.
Really interesting. What about pancreatic polypeptide? Tell us about that.
Yes. So again, it's going to sound kind of familiar. Pancreatic polypeptides manage how you store glucose in your liver, manages your insulin sensitivity, and reduces your insulin needs. So,
okay. So I want to pause there and just like give some cushion to this part of the conversation now that you're bringing insulin sensitivity into this, because I was just doing every morning, I spend some time just reading, you know, diabetes research articles, whatever's, you know, up in the news of today. And there was one that popped up that was actually talking about how insulin resistance is, you know, something that people with type 2 and pre-diabetes experience. And it literally blanked, like, just said straight out, like, it is not something that like is really associated with type 1 unless you are like very obese. And I was like, that I just don't see to be true. I mean, out of all of the people that we work with at Risley, and I'm sure you, all the hundreds of people you've, you know, come across in the stories, like, it's just not the case. I think most people, right, like, it takes a while for their insulin to kick in. It, depending on your insulin sensitivity level and insulin resistance, it's also a spectrum.
Yeah.
And so that, and it's not really like, I remember when I had my first pump, the Medtronic MiniMed years ago, correction factor on there was called insulin sensitivity for whatever reason. And I mean, this is like 20 years ago. And that's what I understood insulin sensitivity to be, like, growing up my whole life. It's like, oh, this is the amount of insulin you take to bring yourself from a high blood sugar down. But I never understood that, hey, even just like 2 to 3 pounds in either direction on your body can really influence your insulin sensitivity and resistance levels. And I think you've said the same too, but for me, I fluctuate, like, I don't know, like between at any given time, like 5 pounds.
Yeah, me too. I have like a 5 pound window. But
yeah, in terms of how your body fits. And it's like, you just can see it directly in how much insulin you're taking, like, immediately. So sorry to jump in on that, but I don't know if anybody listening kind of relates to, you know, the understanding of insulin sensitivity, like really not being taught as like an important piece and really how it's connected. So keep going with the pain.
Well, I talk about that a lot because when I was in my late teens, early college years, I really wasn't taking care of myself, like, for a number of years. I was taking my insulin and doing my best with my diabetes, but my lifestyle habits were cruddy. And my insulin, my long-acting insulin dose was 3 times the amount it is today. And I don't do anything crazy. I don't go to CrossFit. I just jog every day and walk my dog and do some really light weights. And then, you know, my diet is significantly better, but I still eat dessert every day, right? So anyone, diabetes of any type or no diabetes at all, we all have insulin resistance that can fluctuate based on lifestyle habits. I can see if I, you know, I was just in Florida with my children. I was eating much more indulgent food, drinking alcohol much more frequently, and I had a great time. And I knew going there, I'm going to just increase my long-acting insulin dose because I know I'm going to need it. And it helped so much. I raised it by, it's like probably about 30%.
And as you're talking about this, and as we're having this conversation, I'm panning in my mind to somebody, a friend of mine, one of my best friends, his cousin got diagnosed with type 1 about a month and a half ago. And she got diagnosed with a primary doctor. And basically for the whole month after had the, like, in my opinion, it is just a shameful experience of the healthcare system in terms of they just gave her, you know, she was in the hospital. They, you know, it took, they said, okay, you can go home now. Her blood sugar was 300 for weeks. They never give her fast acting insulin. And then finally I was like, you need to go to your doctor and be like, I know that you can't get in with, I know that I can't get in with an endocrinologist right now. So like, you need to give me this because I'm sitting on my couch out of work, like cannot physically just, you know, do anything. And I'm literally like, you know, I'm struggling and I'm like, you shouldn't, like, you need fast acting insulin. So anyways, doctor prescribed it finally. She's finally got into an endo, but all to say, like, I'm thinking from her perspective and how little education she received from that initial onset of that diagnosis and all she's knowing and all many people know when you're newly diagnosed is like, hey, here's a sliding scale of how much insulin you should be giving and depending on what your blood sugar is. And she sent me her, she's now working with a coach on the Risley team, but she sent me initially the picture and it was like, if you're 250, you know, give, and you're eating 30 carbs, give this much. And if you're 200, and it's just like, that's what people anchor into instead of getting a full blown, like, baseline education on all these things that we're talking about here, where it's like, your insulin needs may change like week to week, depending on if you're on vacation with your family or if you're in a regular routine. And it's so, like, simple, yeah, but at the same time, complex, yeah, and takes people, could take people a decade to learn that information themselves.
I mean, I just posted, so I have a YouTube channel, Diabetes Nerd, right? And I just did an episode on stress. And I explained in that when I was going through my divorce, I had like 6 months where I needed 50% more basal insulin.
Oof.
Right? And I didn't care. It was like, I just want to stay in range, right? And I had not gained weight. In fact, I'd lost weight. But those stress hormones were telling my liver to produce more glucose. And that's another thing that drives me a little nuts is, I feel like we've all been taught that certain things cause insulin resistance when it's actually telling our liver to release more glucose, but it's been dumbed down by the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. So we've been taught that Dawn phenomenon hormones produce insulin or lead to insulin resistance. But when you actually look at what those hormones are doing, they're actually telling our liver to produce more glucose.
Yeah.
So there is insulin resistance, right, with lifestyle factors and weight gain and all that. And then there's these hormones, you know, like adrenaline and cortisol. It's not insulin resistance. It's those hormones telling your liver to produce more glucose to give you fuel during stressful situations.
Right, exactly. And you're just requiring more insulin during those times to bring down a type of high blood sugar that's coming down from stress versus another time that your blood sugar is high and you're just, you know, laying on the beach having, you know, a drink.
Yeah. And you need that cortisol. It's an anti-inflammatory. It's there to protect you, right? And ideally we get our cortisol levels back down, right? Because we don't want to all be stressed out all the time.
Yeah, no, for sure. And this is, you know, this is why we're here talking about it so we can understand a little bit, you know, deeper and what's going on and how to then get ahead of it. So the last hormone is ghrelin. Let's talk about this one.
This one I heard a lot about from bodybuilders when I was in my powerlifting days, and I never knew it was associated with type 1. It stimulates your appetite, it increases fat storage, and it stimulates growth hormone release. And so growth hormones are, you know, a whole other set of hormones. But they have found that people with type 1 newly diagnosed have decreased or abnormal ghrelin secretion. So I shouldn't say decreased, I meant abnormal, which could mean up or down. And I know many, and I know myself too, but I didn't know it at the time, who gain weight, a lot of weight in the year after your diagnosis. And looking back, I can see that in myself for sure. And I've seen it in many young people and adults too. And I'm sure ghrelin plays a role in that.
Yeah. And I think it plays a role, right? There's so many different factors. The fact that you lose a lot of weight a lot of people like leading up to diagnosis, and then you're flipping to the other side. I think just like your body is going through a lot of trauma and stress, and like just hormonally, everything is trying to figure out what its, you know, homeostasis like looks like, and that balance. And, you know, with everything that we just talked about, I think it can feel a little just like defeating, where it's like, oh, like how are we have all these things working against us. You know, there are a lot of people listening that are probably thinking in their heads, like, this isn't fair, or, you know, like, why even try? And then some other people being like, all right, just tell me exactly what to do to like not to get ahead of these and not let these impact my life. And I think it's important to remember that there are a lot of people with type 1 diabetes who are just, you know, thriving and not being limited by the fact that all of these things are working against them. And I think people too, like in the context of weight, I think diabetes and insulin and all these can be looked at as like, well, you know, I'm just, that's the problem. It's diabetes and placing the blame on all of that. But then you know that there are also a lot of people with type 1 diabetes who, you know, aren't in larger bodies. And I'm not saying this to say like it's good or bad, but just a like, what are we going to do about it? And how are you going to move forward? Figure out how to best balance your blood sugars, how to have a good relationship with insulin, meet your body with where it's at, and then also having grace for the times where you are just like, you know, maybe eating and you're a little bit full and you're like, all right, well, you know what? Okay, we'll give that one to the amylin in my body or whatever it is. So, you know, if we're talking through like what doesn't help and then what does help, and kind of, you know, wrapping up here to give people like steps and things to think about, what would you say that people do in response to these maybe hormones unknowingly to try to kind of like outsmart them? I know you probably have ideas on this.
Helpful things, you mean?
Well, things that aren't helpful, like for example, like crash diets. Like I was in college a just terrible cycle for years of like, I wouldn't call it a binge restrict. Like I was never eating like everything in the fridge kind of thing, but it was during the week I was limiting my calories and eating super, super clean, no packaged foods. And then when Friday would come, there was this like stress relief from it being the end of the week. And then that would trigger my hunger. And I would just, I mean, you know, it was like, we're baking, we're going out to eat. And it was like this whole 3-day fest of just finding the other side of the balance. But it was constantly this like on or off, all or nothing that I think a lot of the type one sometimes struggle with. So like knowing that, never letting your hunger get to, on a scale of 0 through 10, like a 5 or below, because you know that you are more prone to, you know, being extra, extra hungry, for example.
Yeah. I mean, so I hope you don't mind. I'm going to try to flip this because that's how I can explain it better. Is like, I think that we, if you want to reach certain weight management goals and blood sugar goals, I think we have to take our lifestyle habits very seriously as type ones, because it has such an impact on compensating for all these stupid hormones we don't produce properly. And so like, for example, caffeine, if you're drinking caffeine all day, you are telling your liver to produce even more glucose than it's already producing. So when I learned that caffeine triggers liver glucose, I stopped drinking so much caffeine and I cut my coffee down to one cup a day. And if you're drinking caffeine all day long and you're like, man, I'm so insulin resistant in the afternoons and I don't know why, it might be because you've been, you know, chugging Coke, Diet Coke or coffee all day long. Just because that Diet Coke says zero calories doesn't mean it's not affecting your blood sugar in other ways. So that's a huge one to look at. Just exercising every day. I can tell you, if I don't like hit my more intense, I always walk my dog because you got to walk your dog. But if I, for some reason, don't run for 2 or 3 days in a row, and even if I'm just using my little elliptical I got on the side of the road, but it's not nearly as intense as running, right? It's more like a power walk. I notice a big increase in my insulin needs. And big is all relative, right? But I need like twice as much insulin for lunch if I don't go for a jog in them. So that just demonstrates how much of an impact exercise has on your insulin sensitivity. And if you are currently not exercising at all and you start, give it time to see the like waboom it's going to have over time. Like you'll see that immediate effect, but over the course of 5 years of exercising every day, you'll probably see your insulin needs just continue to decline.
Right. Increasing your insulin sensitivity using exercise and nutrition and stress and sleep management. It's all like the basics of what just humans we should be doing to take care of ourselves. But for type ones, it's just extra, extra important and
magnified.
It's magnified. And I think that when we're told at diagnosis, everyone's told something different, which is, you know, part of the problem of it not being systemized language and what we're learning while learning. But when we're told you know, keep doing whatever you're doing in life. Like, you don't have to change anything. Just give insulin for the food. Like, it's very misleading, because if you're somebody who has never been active in your life, and let's say you're more of like, I don't know, like, not saying that these two things can't happen at once, but like, you're more of like the artistic, creative, maybe like musically inclined person, like those are your passions, versus for me, I grew up super active. I grew up, you know, playing soccer in college. Like, that was, you know, a little bit easier, I imagine, in some ways, that I was set up for success. And that person may think, oh, hey, like, I don't need to change anything, but it's like, but you know, it's going to help you. It's a tool that you have to help make your life with diabetes, you know, easier. One thing I want to wrap and talk about, in addition to what does help in terms of increasing your insulin sensitivity and not doing this like maybe crash diets and thinking through everything we've talked about, you mentioned metformin, and Ozempic is obviously everywhere right now, and would like to talk about metformin and Ozempic. Everyone's going to have different opinions. You're here because I want you to share your opinion. And what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I think once you learn that type ones aren't producing all these hormones that manage all these things that affect weight and appetite, Ozempic and the other GLP-1s like it make a lot of sense for type ones. I think it's, you know, it's really hard to get. I've been on Ozempic for like a year. I have in the past. I've weaned off it because I knew my new insurance wouldn't cover it. And I knew I could get, you know, the reason I started metformin was actually because of Dawn Phenomenon. My Dawn Phenomenon was becoming more and more dramatic as I hit my mid-30s. And I couldn't figure out why. Nothing else had changed. And metformin suppresses liver glucose. Ozempic also does, right? But metformin's really easy to get and really affordable. So it's like the poor man's Ozempic. But GLP-1s, like, I really hate watching people be shamed for needing them. I don't care if you, you know, if you have type 2 and you're living with obesity and you have not changed all those lifestyle habits yet, you are still worthy of taking Ozempic to help you improve those lifestyle habits, to help you improve your relationship with food. I see like that some news dummy was saying, oh yeah, take Ozempic, then eat all the pizza you want. It's like, no, that's not even close to how it works or affects your relationship with food. You might be taking Ozempic to help decrease your cravings for those food and decrease the amount of food that you eat. They're actually studying it for treating addiction too. And addiction includes food addiction, right? So why are we shaming people for it? We don't shame people for needing an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety med. Why are we shaming people for needing help with this? And same with type 1. A significant amount of type 1s are living with obesity. And go figure, because of all the hormones we don't produce properly that cause us to need more insulin, right?
And I think it could be compounded too with if your genetics are more, you know, you're more predisposed towards obesity or food addiction, or you grew up in a household that didn't have a, you know, a balance of what is healthy or didn't have access to healthier food and you're eating more packaged food. So it's so multifaceted.
Yeah. And I mean, I took the lowest dose of Ozempic that the pen will give you, and full disclosure, and I'm not telling anyone to do this, I actually wanted even less. I used a syringe into the Ozempic pen and took out what I think would be a more appropriate dose, because I wasn't taking it for weight loss. I wanted it for all these things of managing appetite and suppressing liver glucose. And it did that for me. I did lose some weight at first that I wasn't, you know, I shouldn't have lost, because it did suppress my appetite too much. I just kind of like forgot to eat. But I gained it back once after that first month or so. And then I'm today at the same weight I was at before Ozempic. And Ozempic just made it easier to manage post. So these hormones also, we didn't even touch on this, but several of these hormones that you're lacking manage how quickly you digest food and empty the glucose from that food into your bloodstream, which leads to post-meal spikes, right? So we're always told like, hey, you got to manage your post-meal blood sugars, but we're actually missing like the hormones that help do that. So it's even harder for us to prevent mm-hmm. post-meal spikes in our blood sugar. And Ozempic delays how quickly you digest food. So does metformin. So it makes it easier. It does change how you have to dose your insulin. You know, you're used to pre-bolusing and you're used to your food hitting your bloodstream faster. So you do need to be more cautious. And either of these medications, you'll see immediate call for a reduction in your insulin doses.
Right. And I think too, it's really important for everybody to know like this is going to work for some people, other things are going to work for others. Like it really is your body, your journey, and figuring out what tool is going to best support you get to your overall goal and what that looks like. And I mean, from my understanding, there's a company, Omada Health, that somebody who we work with at Medtronic just sent it to us. And he was saying, you know, check out this article. And they put out an article that said, putting patients on GLP-1s with health coaches shows better, like health coaching that specifically focuses on behavioral modification are producing better outcomes. And that makes sense, right? It's a tool and understanding that it's going to change all your insulin needs and you still have to work out and like, especially for muscle loss, like all of these different elements, it's not just like this quick fix, but it can really, really help if you are living in a bigger body and really struggling.
Yes. And a lot of those headlines that we've seen, it's like everybody needs to calm down. If you're taking too much Ozempic, yeah, you're going to get sick, just like too much of any medication.
Right.
I would really urge people to like take a low dose and stick with that dose before you titrate up for a while. I know people are vomiting after meals because they're desperate to, you know, fit in their wedding dress or whatever. And it's like, it doesn't have to be that way. If you keep the dose low and just ease your way into it and be patient, you know, like you don't want to lose weight rapidly. It's not going to stay off. Just keep that in mind.
Great tips. Well, Ginger, I think we should end on that note. So much that I learned in this episode, so much I'm sure everybody learned, we all learned together. I appreciate the time and I'm really looking forward to you coming back to talk about the overtreating low blood sugars. We're going to have a great conversation about that. But in the meantime, tell people where they can connect with you, get your books, all of that.
You can find me on gingerviera.com. All my books are on Amazon, Instagram. Type my name in there. I think I'm the only Ginger Vieira out there, fortunately. So, and YouTube, please find my new YouTube channel, Diabetes Nerd.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Ginger. Thank you so much for being here with me today and listening to this episode of Reclaim Your Rise. To let us know that the episodes we're putting out are impactful and to help us get our street cred up and let everyone else know that this is something worthy of their time to listen to, please leave a rating and review on our Apple Podcasts, send the show to other people impacted by T1D or maybe even your doctor, and share it on social media tagging @RiseLeeHealth and @Lauren_Bongiorno. New episodes of Reclaim Your Rise come out every single Tuesday, so make sure you are subscribed to the podcast so that you never miss a beat. Thanks again for listening, and as always, remember, diabetes is a challenge that we did not choose, but one that we can rise above.